Welcome to the What If podcast, conversations about the future. Today I'm joined by Jeremy Wyatt, who's Professor of Robotics at the University of Birmingham. Jeremy's a world-leading expert on AI, machine learning, and dexterous robotics. Jeremy, welcome, and thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks, it's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like to begin by asking you to briefly outline each of what you call the three waves of robotics.
So the three waves idea is a tool I use to try to sort of explain roughly where we are, where we've been, and where we're going. So what I call wave one robotics is what everybody would normally know as industrial robots. So these are typically robot arms, although they could involve, you know, mobile robots, typically working in factories, and they're working in very structured environments. And the reason they have to work in structured environments, so where you're certain where everything is because they are essentially what we call position control devices. So unpacked, that means that those robots are really good at going from a precise point A to a precise point B and back again as many times as you like. And they'll always be positionally very, very accurate. And that is a very simple technology. It's been around almost as long as the computer. It's been around since the early 60s when Engelberger invented the first robot. And it's had an enormous impact on, say, for example, you know, car manufacturing, electronics manufacturing. But it has one important restriction. If you're on that production line and you move the car door by, say, 2 centimeters, everything goes wrong because the object isn't where the robot expects it to be. So it's not able to cope with variation, and it's not able to cope with uncertainty. And our challenge is we've got this fantastic technology, but we can't use it outside of these carefully controlled environments. That wave one I call structured manipulation in structured or carefully controlled environments, but it could be mobility in those as well. Wave two is where we are right now. And wave two has been enabled by something I guess we're going to talk about later on, which is steady improvements in the abilities of various kinds of artificial intelligence methods to deal with uncertainty, change, sensor noise, all of the things that animal brains, including human brains, have to deal with and deal with very, very well. And that variability and uncertainty we've largely dealt with through what we call machine learning algorithms. Not just those, but they've been a big success for AI in the last 20 years. And also through another kind of AI called probabilistic AI, which reasons explicitly about uncertainty. And using machine learning and probabilistic AI, as well as more traditional forms of AI, we can now take mobile robots out of the factories and we can put them in the real world. So, for example, simple problems like getting the robot to know where it is, if it's got a map, and to be able to localize, even though its sensors are not reliable, and to do that accurately. So you can have a self-driving, an autonomous car on the street, and it won't just suddenly run amok and try to drive into the other lane, think it's in the wrong place. That kind of basic technology of knowing where I am in an unstructured environment was a really big step forward for us. And we did that between 98 and 2005. Then the second thing is being able to plan and act, move with those, you know, to know where I want to go in an uncertain world. And that's also been something that we've got a lot better at. And this wave now of technology that's hitting us, it's about mobility, therefore, in unstructured environments, in the regular world. Mobility is actually quite forgiving. So if you have a car or you have an aeroplane, if it's a centimeter or maybe even a meter in the wrong direction, it doesn't matter so much. Well, for a car it would, but not for... So they can cope with quite a lot of positional uncertainty. That means that these technologies, even though they're quite basic, even now, are very, very useful for a wide variety of tasks. So when you switch on the news and you see, I don't know, about, say, you know, a new kind of autonomous drone or an autonomous submarine or autonomous car. These are the technologies that you're getting right now using this stuff, and they're into products already. So, for example, you can go out and buy a Dyson vacuum cleaner, and it knows where it is in your house. It knows where it is in your room. It maybe knows something about the patterns of messiness, and it can use that to operate really effectively. The third wave is still a research problem for us. We haven't cracked it yet. And that's the problem of combining the mobility from the second wave sorry, so the manipulation from the first wave with the ability to deal with a lack of structure and variability in the second wave, putting those together and being able to manipulate objects in unstructured environments. So, for example, picking a pen up off a table, not because you knew precisely where it was, but you just looked at it, you glanced at it, you pick it up, your movement's not precise, you don't know the weight of the pen, you don't know how smooth it is. And this, all of those kinds of uncertainty affect how hard it is or how you should best pick up the object. Manipulation's much less forgiving than mobility. If you're out by a millimeter in manipulation, everything can go wrong for you. So that means it's been much, much harder than the mobility problems. So we're in manipulation. I mean, I work in both, but in manipulation, I would say we're about 15 years behind the mobility guys. So the mobility people are producing technologies for you right now. In manipulation, when we crack these problems, we can talk about how we're going to do that later on. Unstructured manipulation will enable us to get a whole new wave of technologies. We'll be able to manipulate things in the way that animals and people do.
Okay, so when you talk about manipulation and dexterity, I immediately think of the analogy of the human hand. Is that a kind of limited way of thinking about it? Are there other kinds of manipulation and dexterity that aren't about the, you know, visualizing how a robot sort of hand might work?
Well, it's a good first visualization, but you don't have to have five fingers, and they don't have to have five fingers connected to a palm with a thumb, your prehensile grasping, the way that we do. So, for example, if you were to get on a jet plane and go to New Caledonia, and you wandered in the forests of New Caledonia, so not that far from here, you would find a very remarkable creature called the New Caledonian crow. And New Caledonian crows are a wonderful example of non-human, in fact, even non-mammal species that do very sophisticated manipulation using their beaks. So they don't have the same kinds of manipulators that we do, but they will have many of the same underlying technologies. So, for example, the key things are that you have actuators, in our case, muscles, that are capable of being soft. So in other words, when they contact a surface unexpectedly, they yield, they're springy, they're safe. The second thing you need is some kind of, we'll talk about this more in a bit, you need something called prediction. So the animal, whether it's a human or the creature, whether it's a human, a robot or a crow, needs to be able to predict what's going to happen as a result of trying a manipulation action. That's really critical, it turns out. And then the final thing you need is in order to do prediction and also control, to actually do something rather than just predict what might happen if you did something, you need some kind of learning mechanism, because the physics of the world, the mechanics of everyday objects, it turns out, is much, much harder than people think it is. So physicists are probably the most successful scientists, natural scientists, in the sense that they are able to very precisely describe the systems that they study. But one of the reasons they do that is because they simplify those systems enormously. So when you're doing quantum theory, you look at just the hydrogen atom. Or when you're looking at, physical systems, you look at an idealized pendulum and one of the things that it turns out that mechanics is not very good at is dealing with friction.
So as a roboticist, you and your colleagues are routinely looking at the biological world, is that right? For kind of insight into these complex forms of manipulation.
Yes, yeah, right. Absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, computer scientists and engineers are magpies. So we go out and we raid. Rather than stealing shiny trinkets, what we do is we find really interesting ideas. And nature's a tremendous source of inspiration because it's had to solve. And the wonderful thing about, particularly with intelligence, is we have all of these examples of intelligent systems that we can study in order to provide us with inspiration about ways that we might solve these problems. Because, of course, robots and humans, there's no such thing as a non-embodied intelligence naturally, right? All creatures that have had an attack of the smarts have a body. And that means it's very likely, or it's inevitable, I would say, that your brain and the brains of all the animals that are in the world and have preceded us, they've all evolved under the constraints of the physics, of the scale on which we live. So frictional forces, the physics associated with, the way that light shines off surfaces and behaves, the physics of sound, all of these constraints shape our intelligence. And so when you're building robots, you're working under these constraints. When you're studying humans, you're studying, or other animals, you're studying creatures that have evolved their intelligence under these constraints. And so you can learn a lot because those systems are actually very, very, they're solving almost identical problems often.
So in a sense, this bringing together of manipulation and AI isn't really like sort of creating a synthetic mind and a synthetic body and then bringing them together. You're working on embodied intelligence right from the outset, the idea that the robot is always physically situated. Is that right? Have I understood correctly?
I am, yeah. Mm. So there's a whole branch of robotics and AI, which they call it embodied intelligence, and it's an area that gives, it's a community that has given itself a label. And I wouldn't quite describe myself as being a member of that community, but when I first started studying AI, it very quickly became apparent to me that it was very easy to build simulations. And those simulations, obviously, you abstract, as when you do when you build any model in science. And it was often very easy to abstract away the difficult or the interesting things. And so it occurred to me very quickly that robotics is a litmus test for theories of intelligence. If it works in a robot, it really works, albeit within the constraints that you've set up by the mechanics that you put in your robot, or the way that you've engineered perhaps your problem. So you can always cheat in some ways, but in a sense, animals often cheat. So animals change their actuation, or they change their sensing, or they change their morphology, their body shape, in order to make certain problems easier. And fundamentally, I mean, and Dan Wolpert, the neuroscientist, has put this very forcefully, what are brains for? It's a very important question to ask yourself. Why do we have brains? And the answer is, we have brains because we move. So the joke goes, there's a very few creatures that don't move and have brains. And there's one example of, I think it's a sea creature that basically floats around with a quite a complex nervous system for quite a while, and then it finds a home on a rock somewhere, resides there, and then what it does is it says, well, I don't need a brain anymore because I'm not going to move. And so essentially it digests its own brain. And I think the joke goes that the only other type of creature in the world that does this is the tenured professor.
So can you maybe just give us an insight into perhaps one of the projects that you've been working on that seeks to implement this or sort of develop this frontier of this third wave?
So in the work we're doing in dexterous manipulation, what we've been looking at, so we've played a little bit. So there's several things that we need that we're missing at the moment. So first of all is we need physically soft robots. And I'm not a mechanical engineer, so I rely on other collaborators to provide us with new kinds of hardware. And there's a couple of kinds that are very interesting. So one kind is a kind called they're called actively compliant robots. And these have actually now become quite wide. They're becoming, you can go out, you know, as an industry person and buy one. You probably can't buy one for your house yet, but you're going to get there. And these are robots that, you remember when I talked about wave one, traditional robots are position control devices. They go from A to B. If something gets in the way, you want to get in the way of that robot, you're going to have a pretty hard time because it's going to use as much force as it needs to in order to get through you. Whereas the thing about humans is we're terrible position control devices. So if you try to move your finger from A to B and back again, I can guarantee you will never end up in the same place twice. We're very, very poor at positional control. But what we're wonderful at, and as are all other animals, is force control. We're extremely good at exerting just the amount of fine force that we need in order to execute a task. So that means we've got to completely redesign the robots. So the first wave of doing this with these things called actively compliant robots, and basically what they do is they're position control machines which sense forces, and then they sense the forces that are being exerted and they fake springiness in their software. And they do this very, very fast, about 40,000 times a second, the best ones. And that makes them pretty useful for tasks where they're not moving very, very quickly towards a surface. But the problem is that if you have say, for example, a task like hammering a nail, you took your rather expensive, rather nice robot to do this task, and it would break in a moment because the transmission of the mechanical forces is essentially instantaneous, and it would beat the software every time. So then there's two other things we can do. Number one is that we can actually make robots to be physically springy. And you can now, we now have these. So these are robots that they have a motor, traditional electric motor, but then they have a spring, a physical spring, rather than a software spring, a virtual spring. So a physical spring between them and their, what we call their end effector, essentially their hand or their gripper. And that means that they are physically soft. And that means you could, in principle, if they could exert enough force, use those for hammering and they would be safe or some other similar task. And that makes them mechanically much safer. And it also, interestingly, when you have different mechanical properties in your body, and this is your point about embodied intelligence, you have very different computational problems for the intelligent part. So having the right body enables you to have a much simpler brain and yet do as well, or in fact better, than you would do with the wrong body and a much more complicated brain. There's another kind of actuation which we also try, which is not springiness, either in software or physically. It's called underactuation. This is where you have robots that are, they have maybe many, you have a hand which has many degrees of freedom, so its fingers can move in many ways, but they only have one muscle. And then you'll have something like a tendon, rather like the ones you have in your hands. But the tendon might run up and down in a single line between all of the different fingers. So when you contract the in this case, the not a muscle, but the when you draw in the motor, the tendon draws in the fingers of the hand. And what this does is then, because you've only got one degree of what we call one motor, but many ways that the hand can be configured, when you go to grasp an object or try to manipulate it, the fingers will naturally wrap around the object as they try to distribute the force evenly along the tendon. This is a very elegant solution. It has some problems. So you have to have the right kinds of hardware. The second thing you need is you need the ability to do machine learning. So that's very much something that's what we do in my lab. So we take these various devices that we have and we now use the best machine learning algorithms that we have available to us. And we try to get the robot to learn either from demonstration. So we demonstrate to the robot how to grasp a cup, for example. And then what we do is we then have another kind of learning called reinforcement learning, where the robot can learn by itself. Now, that can be quite dangerous. So we often only do it in simulation. So now the robot's experimenting. Sometimes you can do it with a real robot. The experiment's experimenting, picking up cups or, you know, manipulating objects in simulation. And then what it does is it then applies the ones that work in the real world. So these kinds of machine learning algorithms are very powerful, particularly when combined with the right kinds of hardware. And the third thing you need is the right kind of sensing. And this is where third wave robotics is behind the curve, in the sense that we really struggle. People would be really surprised to hear this, I think, but robots' sense of touch is abysmal in comparison with even, you know, quite simple animals. And it's very difficult to build touch sensors that are sensitive and give you enough information to be able to manipulate an object. And people don't realize quite how important their sense of touch is to manipulation. So building the right kinds of sensors, having the right kinds of algorithms, which typically means, in our case, means using machine learning, and then also the right kind of hardware. And those are the things that we're experimenting with at the moment.
So this connects presumably to this paradox that you've talked about, that in broad terms, what's easy for, what comes naturally to most humans is very difficult in a robot, and vice versa, and to some extent. And so third wave robotics is about addressing that paradox. Is it about potentially cracking that paradox so that it no longer exists anymore, or is that always going to be a sort of uphill struggle, do you think?
Okay, so what you're referring to is this thing called, it's called Moravec's paradox. It's named after an important robotics and AI researcher called Hans Moravec. He was the first person to note it. All the things that are relatively hard for humans to do, the things that we think about as only really smart people are good at, right? We crack those in AI unbelievably quickly. So, for example, we had in 1948, Claude Shannon, the inventor of information theory, invented the core, essentially, of algorithms for chess playing. So only really smart people are good at chess. I'm terrible at chess. And, you know, there are algorithms, you know, that have they've improved a bit. But the point was, we cracked that problem really early. So the Deep Blue, I think it was called, when it beat Kasparov in 95, was essentially using the same kind of tree search, the same kind of number crunching, with some efficiencies that had been designed in the 1940s. By 1962, we had a computer program that could get an A on the MIT calculus paper, on the MIT integral calculus paper. And that's something that only, you know, pretty good students at MIT can do well on. And yet, at the same time that there was a researcher called Marvin Minsky, who's one of the founders of AI as a discipline, at the same time that he was working on solving how to do integral calculus with a computer and doing it really well, he was also trying to build a robot that could catch a ball. And he was doing really, really badly. And the reason is that, as you've identified, these things that we find really easy, conversely, are very, very hard to put into machines. And there's a couple of reasons. One, we find it very easy to articulate what we're doing when we're doing integral calculus, if we can do it, or when we're playing chess. We can't do that. When you're walking down the street, you don't sort of go, oh, yes, I can feel neuron C1 in this particular cortex firing. You can't say what's happening. The second thing is that the maths just turns out to be more difficult. And the third thing was, of course, for a very long time, and even now to an extent, we haven't had the right kind of hardware. So I think that the paradox will continue, but it's the way to think about AI is that we're almost working backwards. We sort of did the stuff that requires apparently lots of intelligence very early on, and then we're sort of working backwards through the problems that we don't think are so hard. But in fact, if you think about it, which evolution has spent most of its time on? So, you know, moving around in the world, surviving, perceiving, acting, taking into account, you know, risk and benefit. Those are the things that matter if you're going to pass your genes on to the next generation. Being able to write a beautiful symphony or solve a difficult equation has very little evolutionary value.
So what sort of applications of third wave robotics in the future sort of excite you most? What do you think some of the most significant social benefits might be from this latest or newest wave of robotics?
Well, I mean, so there's going to be huge benefits, obviously, there's been huge benefits from both the previous wave, the first one, and the second one. The second one, in a sense, is the thing that people are going to experience in the next 10 to 15 years. They're going to see their lives benefiting from that. So probably, you know, 10 years is a pretty long time to think about. So probably you're not going to see third wave robotics for at least that period of time. I would expect to start seeing things in sort of 15 years. There will be things that happen in the short term, but you often won't be able to see them in your life. Because one of the things with the third wave robotics is that it's not ready for consumer product, A, because the robots are really expensive and they're quite hard to get cheaper. It's pretty difficult to build a good robot arm for under about $20,000, 20,000 New Zealand dollars. The second thing is that where they really bring value is going to be in tasks where there's a lot of money. So this is doing things like, you know, drilling for deep sea oil, making cars more efficiently. It's all the things that are hidden from us in the everyday world. So they're not going to be so much consumer products. There'll be a little bit of that. Having said that, they will be used. I think some of these technologies will turn up in consumer products and specialist places. So, for example, there's a lot of work going on with exoskeletons at the moment. So people who can't walk, either because of paralysis or limb loss or some kind of motor neuron disease, stroke, they will be enabled to walk using things like exoskeletons. And we will also see those used in industry in order to massively increase the strength of people to be able to carry out tasks that they couldn't carry out otherwise. And I think those are going to use, and they are already using, some of these new insights about how to act in the face of collisions. I mean, essentially, when you're touching something, you're colliding with it. And that's when forces really matter, much more than position. You know, the wrong position induces forces that are very, you know, potentially very dangerous. And so exoskeletons could be a big area where we can benefit. Additionally, force control. And we have robot surgery. So robot surgeons are not autonomous. And I'm not sure it necessarily should be autonomous, but there's a possibility there that we might be able to do much better with a machine that is no longer operated by a human surgeon than with a than a human surgeon operating the machine. And so there's a question, well, would you prefer to go and be operated on purely by a robot if you knew that it increased your chances of success in your operation from, say, 60% to 85%? Right. And that might be a choice that patients are able to make. But at the moment, those are not autonomous. But to make them autonomous, we would have to exploit some of this. It will also have a lot of impact in things, for example, I think labor-intensive industries, because one of the things people don't realize is one of the first things that people say to you when you're a roboticist is, are they going to take all our jobs? And what, looking ahead, actually, if you look at the demographics of the human population, particularly in, say, you know, wholly industrialized countries, advanced economies, our demographics are pretty horrible. So, for example, tens of millions of people in Europe are going to leave the workforce and not be replaced because we're not having babies fast enough. Well, if you're going to maintain the same standard of living but with a smaller workforce and but still with a population that's still as big because people are getting older, how are you going to do that? Well, you're going to have to massively increase your productivity. And people also don't want to do these very, one of these very menial backbreaking jobs. So, for example, if you go out and you pick fruit, that's a tough living. And so we ought to be able to make people much more productive in these tasks. And that's going to require this kind of dexterous manipulation, soft robotics. We're going to be applying to, we'll be people applying it in logistics, people applying it in manufacturing, people applying it in agriculture. And so that's where I see it. It's going to be the kind of the backroom stuff initially. So you're going to have to wait a while for your robot that's going to do your, stand there and clean your house and do your dishes, because it's just not an economic proposition at the moment. You probably wouldn't be prepared to pay $2 million for a robot that did that and broke after a week.
So it's inexorably tied up with economics, but also you mentioned in the example of the robot surgeon, questions about social perceptions as well. And I just perhaps want to conclude by asking you, as a roboticist, what you make of the kind of current state of public understanding around the future of robotics, the hopes, the fears, the you know, sort of in many ways colored by visions from science fiction. You know, what do you think is sort of happening in terms of public understanding, and what could be done to open that up a little bit?
So I would use two words to describe where we are in terms of general understanding of these technologies: curiosity and narratives. So people are at the stage where robots, you know, when you say you're a roboticist or you take your robot to to an event, people are really, really interested. They really want to know, what can it do? How does it work? People are fascinated to play with them, just as they're fascinated to play with any other creature that they find. And so that curiosity is a wonderful thing, because it's the stage at which people are willing to accept a technology in some form, trying to figure out what it can be used for, what do we want it to be used for. That curiosity just to find out how things work, which is so innate to us as creatures, that's really, I think, that drives a lot of how the public react. And then there'll be a stage of, once they're familiar with these things, even as they're changing, when it's used, and you're familiar with something, once you actually use it as a user. So, for example, people probably couldn't imagine, you know, well, they probably could imagine, but they probably wouldn't know exactly that kind of experience of extreme emotional frustration that suddenly I get when I go to the supermarket and I use the automated checkout and it's misinterpreting what I'm doing, or it's giving me instructions I don't need. That interaction, I find a really frustrating interaction, and that could be smoothed by having better AI. But until you've actually interacted with one of those things, you don't really know whether it's going to be a boon or a blessing. And so people will have to actually interact with robots, I think, to really get a sense of, oh, so this is what it does. And it's very interesting when you... So we did some studies over the last few years where we were taking mobile robots into a couple of different places, so office buildings, where they were working long-term, so over several months with the office workers. And they were basically just doing patrolling and security. So we were working with a security company, and then we were working it was essentially a research organization. So these were all people who were quite tech-savvy. And it was very interesting watching how they interacted with them, you know, how they become familiar with the robot and adapt to it. And often what they'll do is they will have a period, again, of curiosity, then they'll ignore it, And they will then, but then they'll adapt around the robot to help the robot often. So, for example, you have people opening doors for the robot. And then you can see on the robot's camera afterwards is that they nod to the robot. It's okay, you can go through the door now. The robot has no idea that it's being nodded at. It just sort of sees the open door and heads on through. And we also took it into for example, a residential facility with senior citizens that was in Vienna. And what was really interesting was their expectation, once they knew that the robot could generate speech, they thought it must understand everything that they said. And of course, then they were very disappointed when they discovered that it didn't. So there's this kind of familiarization thing we have to go through. But the other thing that's, and this is more dangerous, is narratives. So as humans, we understand the world through narratives. It's one of our principal mechanisms for comprehension of a sequence of events. We tell a story about it. We are innately creatures that tell stories, and we understand the world through stories. And we shape our understanding of robotics through stories. And unfortunately, those stories are almost wholly negative. And that's a cultural thing. So, for example, I mean, you can go back. The idea of having a creature that you have created that in some sense is like you in the sense that it has life or sentience or something like this. And I don't think that these devices do, but that's the way that people think about them. And then it turns on you. It turns on its creator. And that myth almost goes all the way back even to the Bible. You can look at Genesis 1 and sort of, you know, say, well, you know, Adam and Eve were given autonomy and then they blew it. And, you know, Frankenstein, all of these. And that story, that's a very negative story. It's also, I think, fortunately, the wrong narrative. And what I hope is that over time, as people become familiar with the technology, that the familiarity will show them that obviously that's not the right narrative to think about. And we might get away from that at least, or at least we can separate these two things. We can still enjoy going and watching Terminator without sort of being worried that our toaster's going to come and try and strangle us in the middle of the night.
Just one final question sort of on that. I wonder if third wave robotics raises new challenges around the idea of the uncanny valley. I was thinking of a video of a robot doing somersaults and backflips out of a Boston robotics lab recently that caused so much fascination, but also, you know, creeped people out as well. And people immediately thought of RoboCop and so on. I wonder if there are, you know, we normally think of the uncanny valley, this sort of creepiness effect that we get from a robot that seems both to be very lifelike, but also sort of falls into the gap between the animate and the inanimate. And once robots are using sort of fine motor skills, displaying body language that's more reminiscent of humans and other living creatures, does that bring potentially with it new barriers in terms of people's psychological acceptance and comfort?
Yes, I think it does. I think it absolutely does. I think that's so one of the fascinating things. So obviously the movies you're referring to of the Atlas robot series at Boston Dynamics, and those, you know, anyone can go out on YouTube and there's a little rabbit hole of nightmares out there for you. But also very fascinating stuff. I mean, what was interesting was my own reaction. So the first Boston Dynamics robot that I saw that freaked me out was a robot called Big Dog. It was about 10 years ago, which was a four-legged pack carrying robot, like basically a robot mule, which they developed for the army to carry packs so the soldiers wouldn't have to. And it was never used. It probably never will be used because it's too noisy. But I remember watching that and watching its motion and feeling this sense of how biological it felt in the way that it moved. And it was that I remember I was quite spooked by it. The weird thing is now is I can go back and watch those movies and I'm not spooked by them anymore. I was fascinated by the Atlas videos, and everybody can sort of see what it can do. And the fascinating thing about Boston Dynamics, you have, I think, really the edge, not even the edge, they're far out in terms of the hardware elements and many of the low-level control elements. And they're doing things that actually nobody knows quite how they're doing them. So we don't know, for example, how long they took to program that series of jumps and backflips. My suspicion is it was quite a while, and that if you did it differently, you know, if you tried to get it to jump two steps rather than one, they'd be there for another 2 months doing the coding. But we are getting better, and those things are very impressive. I think they will spook people a bit. There is something about having a machine that has motion that's similar to creatures, you know, organic creatures, that's a bit freaky. And we're just going to have to see if it's innate or if it's a sort of a first response thing. You know, are you always going to be spooked? My experience is, having watched these movies now for 10 years, I'm less spooked than I was. And I think I can get used to it. But yeah, it's going to be a big issue. Robot acceptance is a massive issue for us. And building robot, people are much more comfortable, as you know, with robots that feel really robot-y. People like them. The moment they begin to feel a little bit too good, that's when the problems start. Actually, I think one of the problems in the future is, whatever robot body you have and whatever it's capable of doing, one of our big problems is going to be, once we're familiar with robots, is going to be robot abuse. So, and I this is not a trivial point. So, for example, imagine you develop a line of street cleaning robots and you put them on the streets of some major city, say London or Auckland or something. How many, I wouldn't even say how many days, how many hours do you think it's going to be before somebody comes along and says, hey, do you know what? This would be really fun to mess with this robot. And also, because it's very difficult to build robots that it's easy to interact with, very hard to build robots to interact with. So there was a nice story, I only found out about it yesterday, about a robot, I think it was one of the Pepper series from SoftBank, that was being used in a supermarket in Scotland. And it got the sack because it was sending people to the wrong section of the supermarket. And the reason it was doing it is because interacting with people using natural language is really hard. And I don't see any progress in that, in terms of really deep conversation anytime soon, because you have to have robots, you would have to have common sense, you have to have a deep level of pragmatics and ability to appreciate emotional nuance in intonation, in facial expression, in gesture. That's all unsolved. So I think that robots interacting with people will remain laughably bad for a while yet. We'll get there in the end. And for some things, like, for example, you know, products like Siri and Alexa, they're very good at speech recognition now. I think one of the things we will crack, actually, which is not a robot problem, but it's more of a machine learning problem, which is, I think we will crack machine translation. We're getting better at it. And the idea of having a speech recognition system that does live translation for you, so that you could hop on the plane to Beijing, stick, I guess it's a babelfish, right? It's you know, stick the babelfish in your ear and have a conversation with a Chinese person on the street with you speaking in English and them speaking in Mandarin. I think that's much closer than we realize. And there's a very long history, actually, of whenever we invent a new computing technology, we think it's going to replace humans, and it never does. It always augments. It always adds to our abilities. And the favorite thing, if you look around the world, what are most computers used for, or most computers used for most of the time? It's getting a human to communicate with another human.
That's probably a good note on which to close. Jeremy Wyatt, thank you.
Thank you very much.